his head so that he no longer stared out the window, but instead was studying them. He said nothing, but it was easy to see that he was aware of his visitors, and she wondered what had to be going through his mind. There was understandable pain, grief, and loss in his eye, but Georgiou thought she saw something else as well. Hope?
They're going to find him, Tommy, said Jim.
He glanced to his mother before turning to Georgiou. His expression softened.
So, you think this will help?
Oh, yes, she replied. It's going to help a lot.
21. By design, the interrogation room was a dull, uninviting box. Formed from thermoconcrete, its walls, floor, and ceiling were painted a drab gray. A single lighting panel was set into the ceiling, sealed behind a seamless, translucent screen. The panel also housed sensor equipment that allowed for the monitoring and recording of interview sessions. A single door in the east wall, also painted gray, was the room's only exit. A rectangular table, formed from some composite material and painted to match the room's monotone scheme, sat in the middle of the room, flanked by two chairs on the side closest to the door and a single chair opposite them. Even the chairs were gray. Sitting in the single chair, his hands secured to the armrests and his yellow jumpsuit providing the room's only other source of color, was Alexander Simmons.
"Nice job catching this guy," said Georgiou,
as she stood before a small viewing screen set into the wall of a control room adjacent to the interrogation room. Here, a member of the security staff was able to oversee all interviews, making a record of each session and ensuring that such activities were carried out in accordance with applicable laws and regulations. Standing next to her, Lorca replied, "Thanks. He did a pretty good job hiding, but his mistake was staying in the city. Once Soltani had a trail to follow, it was inevitable we'd track him down."
"My compliments to your team."
She studied the array of small monitors dominating the wall to her right. Each screen offered a piece of the biometric puzzle that was the process of monitoring the interview subject's vital signs and reaction to any stimuli, be it a change in the room's lighting or temperature, or an introduction of various sounds designed to place the person on edge. There also were indicators that could reveal the subtle changes in respiration or pulse rate that almost always accompanied a subject's attempt at deception.
"What do we know about him?"
Lorca said, "He's a watch commander at one of the larger precincts in the city. I pulled his personnel file, and it shows that he arrived on Tarsus IV from Earth with the same group of colonists that included Kodos. He's been a civilian security specialist for 15 years, mostly at various facilities on Earth and Mars. Coming here was the first time he'd even left the Sol system." Georgiou was surprised by that bit of information. Given the relative ease and convenience of modern space travel, it was rare to encounter someone who had never ventured beyond the confines of their home solar system. Even her own parents had traveled to Vulcan, as that planet, along with other Federation planets, was always expanding its capacity and willingness to host outworlders curious to experience firsthand the culture of another world and civilization.
"What about his girlfriend?"
asked Georgiou. "Joanna Robarge. She's a local. Already told us everything she knew, which wasn't much. Simmons came to stay with her the night of the massacre and took off a couple of times in the middle of the night. He didn't tell her what he was up to."
Georgiou frowned. "She shot at you?"
"She says she thought we were protesters. A few security officers have been attacked and harassed since all this started." Lorca grunted in annoyance. "She doesn't know anything useful, but I might still be able to use her when talking to Simmons."
"Do we know if Simmons knew Kodos before they came here?"
Frowning, Lorca shook his head. "No, but I do know a way to find out."
He gestured toward the viewing screen.
"Lead the way, Commander."
They exited the room into a narrow hallway, which, like everything else on this underground level of the security force's main precinct headquarters, was also constructed of thermoconcrete. There were no windows, but the passage was well illuminated, thanks to lighting panels set at regular intervals into the ceiling. Someone had taken pity on the men and women working here and painted the walls a soothing beige. Colored lines ran along the floor, and Georgiou guessed they were intended as visual cues for prisoners moving or being escorted within the holding facility. Signage along the walls provided directions to different offices and other rooms, or listed some rule or regulation that needed following by anyone in this section of the building, prisoner and law enforcement officer alike. It was but a few steps to the interrogation room, which at present was guarded by a single female security officer. She was dressed like her male counterparts in dark uniform shirt and trousers, her pants legs tucked into her polished black boots. Her blonde hair was cut short, with no ponytail or long tresses to be grabbed by an unruly prisoner. There was no holstered phaser on her belt, but instead a thin cylinder Georgiou recognized as an extendable stun baton. The guard, whose security badge identified her by last name as Sullivan, nodded at their approach.
"Good evening."
Lorca said, "We're here for a chat with our guest, Officer Sullivan." Instead of replying, the guard turned to the keypad mounted to the wall beside the interrogation room's door and entered a 6-digit code Georgiou did not see. The pad status light changed from red to green and the door slid aside.
"You've got a visitor," said Sullivan, poking her head into the room. "Behave yourself or no dessert."
"Still not funny," replied a voice from beyond the doorway.
Allowing herself a small smile at the guard's joke before schooling her features, Georgiou followed Lorca into the room. She took in her surroundings, verifying that the gray paint was as dreary and perhaps even as soul-crushing as she gathered from the sensors. She then directed her attention to the room's sole occupant, taking in her first unfettered view of Alexander Simmons. The man sported several days' worth of beard growth, and his brown hair was unkempt. There were dark circles under his eyes, and for a brief moment, Georgiou wondered how long it had been since he last slept.
"Actually, I don't really give a damn."
Instead of taking one of the chairs, Lorca moved to stand behind them, his hands held at his sides. Georgiou stepped into the room and moved far enough from the door that it slid closed behind her, and she heard it lock once it cycled shut. She watched as Simmons turned and locked gazes with Lorca, the two men sizing each other up. According to Lorca, it was the first time the two were seeing each other since the other man's capture. It seemed to take Simmons a moment to realize how he knew the commander, after which he nodded in apparent recognition.
"You," he said.
It was a single word, but as Simmons was the first one who spoke, Lorca was the winner of the little staring contest, along with the battle to see who would initiate a conversation. Georgiou knew that such minor victories actually were helpful tools for the person conducting the interview, as a subject's need to break their silence was a potential weakness to be exploited. It indicated an openness to suggestion, as well as a strong, if misguided, sense of self-preservation. She harbored no doubt that Lorca knew all of this.
"Are you enjoying your stay with us, Mr. Simmons?"
Letting the question hang in the air, Lorca said nothing else. It did not take long for his prisoner to rise to the bait.
"Another comedian. Wonderful."
Shaking his head, Simmons added,
"I've been a security officer for 20 years. I know how this works."
Lorca crossed his arms. 15 years. "I've read your file, moron.
If you're going to start this with a very bad and very obvious lie, it's just going to piss me off. Since I'm already pissed off at you for shooting at me, imagine how fun I'll be when you add to that."
Georgiou could not help glancing at Lorca as he spoke, listening to the hard edge in the man's voice. Was it her imagination, or was she detecting something more than the tough guy act the commander was affecting?
"Whatever."
Simmons scowled.
"It's easy to talk when I'm strapped to a chair. Let me up and we can see how things go."
Grunting in apparent amusement, Lorca began moving to his left, making his way around the table.
"That's probably not a good idea. You see, while you're in the chair, I'm not allowed to hurt you. I'm not even allowed to touch you. I free you, and all bets are off."
Pausing less than an arm's length from Simmons, he leaned forward until his face was mere centimeters away from the other man's right ear. In a low voice, he added,
"Right now, the only place on this entire damned planet where your sorry ass is safe is in that chair."
If it was an act, Lorca was very good at it, Georgiou decided.
If it was something else, then she began to wonder if there might be potential trouble here.
"Me know you're a friend of Adrian Kodos," she said,
attempting to ease the room's brewing tension. It earned her a momentary glower of contempt from Lorca as he backed away from Simmons, but he said nothing, so she continued.
"You came here from Earth with him and several other colonists. We know you helped him on the night of the murders."
Simmons glared at her.
"I didn't."
"We know you were on duty that night, and you were at the amphitheater. We also know from visitor logs that you met with Kodos at the governor's office the day before his execution order came down. Those same logs indicate you've been there more than once, even though your duties don't typically require you to interact directly with the governor."
Giorgio stepped closer to the table.
"Why were you there?"
His features twisting into a mask of anger, Simmons all but snarled at her, but said nothing.
"Why didn't you report for duty the day after the murders?" asked Lorca, getting back into the game.
Stepping behind Simmons, he began a pacing circuit around the table.
"You disappeared. Didn't go to work. Didn't go home. You were a damned ghost, until I found you last night cowering like a rat in your girlfriend's house."
Once again back in front of Simmons, he stopped and placed his hands flat on the table, resting on his extended arms as he faced the other man.
"You help murder 4,000 defenseless people, then crawl into some hole like the coward you are. Mothers, fathers, husbands and wives, friends and lovers, you just burn them to the ground like the crops you had to torch to keep the fungus from spreading. Is that what you thought those people were? An infection to be wiped out in order to have a better chance of saving your own hide? You're not worth the time it'd take to recharge my phaser after I kill you while you're sitting in that damn chair."
Returning Lorca's fierce stare, Simmons said,
"I thought you said I was safe in this chair." "I lied."
Giorgio flinched at the sudden explosion of movement as Lorca used one hand to sweep the table out of his way. It slid across the room and clattered against the thermoconcrete wall, but by then Lorca was already on Simmons. His right hand closed around the restrained man's throat, and Giorgio could see that he was applying great pressure to his grip as Simmons's face began turning red. His eyes were wide with surprise and terror, and he muttered something indecipherable.
"Mr. Lorca!"
It took a second shout before Lorca reacted to his own name. He released his grip on Simmons, who began sputtering and coughing as he leaned forward in his chair. Spittle escaped his mouth and dampened the front of his yellow coveralls.
"Wait outside!" Giorgio snapped,
fixing Lorca with the hard glare she reserved for junior subordinates who did something stupid through apathy or laziness. The commander said nothing. Instead, he drew a deep breath before nodding in acknowledgement of her order. With a final accusatory look in Simmons's direction, Lorca turned and walked toward the door. Giorgio waited until he was in the corridor and the door once again closed, before returning her attention to Simmons.
"He could have killed me," snapped the prisoner.
Giorgio shrugged.
"I should have let him."
That got the man's attention, and he sat straighter in his chair.
"On the other hand, a dead man can't answer any questions. The ball's in your court, Mr. Simmons."
"I'm not saying another word until I talk to a lawyer."
Shaking her head, Giorgio replied,
"I guess you're forgetting the colony is still under martial law, and Governor Ribeiro has granted us wide latitude to search for Kodos. That includes how we deal with anyone who helped him."
She stepped closer. "You don't have many options at the moment.
I'd think carefully about how you want this to go."
In truth, she was not comfortable with the suspension of civil liberties that came with imposing military rule over a civilian populace. It was a tool for use in extreme circumstances, and while the current situation qualified, Giorgio knew it was a practice that was vulnerable to abuse. Despite the pressing need to restore order and locate Kodos, she and the rest of the Starfleet contingent were obligated to proceed with caution and awareness here. Though Simmons's breathing had returned to normal, his face was still flushed.
"What about Joanna?"
"She's been very cooperative. Told us everything she knew. I guess she hates the idea of 10 years in a Federation penal colony for firing a weapon at Starfleet officers."
"She's not involved in any of this."
Simmons was testing his restraints, but his wrists moved not 1 centimeter from the chair's armrests.
I told her you were rioters, looking for a fight. She didn't know who you really were. She doesn't know anything except what I told her, and I lied to her to keep her out of it.
Out of what? Simmons rolled his eyes.
All of this.
Still strapped to the chair, but without the table in the way, to Giorgio he somehow looked even more vulnerable. Fine. What doesn't she know? Sighing, Simmons said,
She has no idea I was there that night, or that I had anything to do with it. The less she knows, the better.
It was Giorgio's first encounter with someone who admitted to having any involvement in that night's horrific events. This was different from people like Gabriel Lorca, who witnessed it from afar, or even young Jim Kirk and Tommy Layton, who watched the massacre unfolding just meters before their very eyes. Here was a man who just admitted to being responsible, or complicit at the very least, to the mass murder of thousands of people.
I should have just let Lorca choke him.
All right, she said. You were there. Give me one reason why I shouldn't just throw you into the deepest, darkest hole I can find. Simmons hung his head, a gesture that to Giorgio appeared motivated by a combination of shame, guilt, and simple resignation over his current situation. When he did look up again, it was to cast his gaze toward the interrogation room's dull gray ceiling.
Because I didn't kill anyone. In fact, I was one of the people Kodos wanted to die that night.
22. Excerpt from The 4000, Crisis on Tarsus IV. The visitor's courtyard, like most of the New Zealand penal settlement, is oddly welcoming. Well-manicured lawns, trees, and gardens are interspersed with low-rise buildings featuring large windows, balconies, and rooftop pavilions. People move about in the open air free of restraint, with light gray uniforms the only distinguishing feature separating guards from residents. Those sent here as punishment and for rehabilitation are not called prisoners or inmates, and neither is other jargon normally associated with a detention facility used, at least by the staff. To the casual observer, the settlement is more gated community or retirement village than prison.
Oh, it's still a prison, all right,
says Alexander Simmons, the subject of today's interviews.
They treat us very well, of course, and there are all kinds of rules residents have to follow, but so long as you do what you're supposed to do, they maintain a hands-off approach for the most part.
He offers a wry smile.
All that changes if you try going over the wall, though.
It's an expression, of course. There is no wall surrounding the penal colony, which sits on a bluff overlooking the ocean on New Zealand's northeastern coast. The air is a bit cool, but not so uncomfortable that it prohibits sitting outside and enjoying the early spring sun and breeze. Except for a transporter inhibitor field and restricted airspace around the facility, there are no barriers preventing exit and entry to the facility. Every resident is fitted with an ankle bracelet that constantly transmits biometric information, as well as the individual's location, to the colony's central computer system. Any attempt to leave the colony or to circumvent or remove the monitor would trigger an alarm, as well as initiate a stun effect on the wearer's nervous system before dispatching an alert to the computer notifying security staff of the incident. Would-be escapees are then remanded to the colony's Enhanced Detention Section, or the box, as residents call it, to serve out whatever punitive duration they receive in relation to their violation. A check of the section's current population shows that there are no occupants, a statistic that has remained unchanged for nearly 5 years.
Somebody tried it back when I first arrived, says Simmons,
running a hand through his thinning hair, which has gone somewhat gray since his being remanded to the colony in 2247.
Thought he could reprogram the locator and feed it updates with a portable scanner to fool the guards. He got as far as the beach before the locator figured it out and zapped him.
He laughs.
Guy spent 6 months over in the box. Idiot.
Simmons is 8 years into a 20-year sentence, and records indicate he has been a model resident from his first moments at the facility. The punishment he received could have been much more severe
and he is well aware of that fact.
They could have sent me to Elba II, or one of the really remote penal colonies. I guess nothing we have is as bad as a Klingon gulag, but that doesn't mean it would have been a picnic either. So I'll take what they give me and keep my mouth shut.
A check of his record shows that due to his good behavior while in residence, Simmons has been considered for parole. He has refused that opportunity, instead making personal requests to the facilities director to stay here in order to carry out the full term of his incarceration.
I deserve worse. The judges didn't think so, but that doesn't mean I can't believe otherwise. They sent me here, and I intend to serve out every last second of my term. It's the least I can do.
During his stay, Simmons has made himself available to facility staff as an instructor and mentor to other residents, teaching classes and even assisting in the training of officers in various security-related subjects. According to his quarterly reviews, he has never given any cause for concern or complaint by any member of the staff. Alexander Simmons looks around the garden where today's interview is being conducted. We occupy a park bench situated at the edge of a large open meadow. Other residents are nearby, either walking, jogging, or just lying in the afternoon sun. A few guards are visible, but their presence is obvious without being obtrusive. They patrol the paths that encircle the meadow and wind through the gardens and clusters of trees. Sensors and other monitoring devices track residents' movements, so the guards are on hand mostly to respond to alerts issued by the colony computer system. He raises his head, enjoying the feel of the warm sun on his skin.
Fresh air instead of an underground bunker on an asteroid or a planet with a poisonous atmosphere? I'll take it. They let us have visitors, and even furloughs after so many months of good behavior. Joanna comes to see me a couple of times a week, and I'm due for a furlough next month.
He casts his gaze toward the small meadow's lush green grass.
Truth be told, and when it's all said and done, I got off easy.
During his trial, it was revealed that Alexander Simmons was a friend and follower of Governor Adrian Kodos. They were acquainted on Earth prior to their departure for Tarsus IV, members of a group interested in beginning a new chapter in their lives.
The main thing that's wrong with life on Earth is that there's pretty much nothing wrong with life on Earth.
He gestures, indicating the meadow and the rest of the facility grounds.
This is jail, for crying out loud. The only real challenges regular people face are the silly ones they make up to alleviate boredom. Mountain climbing, orbital skydiving, exploring the bottom of the ocean.
He frowns.
People with too much time on their hands do that kind of thing. Or they just lie around reading or doing pretty much nothing of any consequence.
He points toward the sky.
For a real challenge, you have to get out there. If you join Starfleet or work for them as a civilian, you can at least go and explore new worlds, maybe meet some alien race we've never seen before, or find the ruins of a civilization that died out millions of years before life even existed here on Earth.
There's a pause and a nod of appreciation.
I can respect the people who choose that sort of life, but it was never for me. Instead, I wanted to get away from the easy life on Earth and try something different. To make something out of nothing, or almost nothing. That's what colony life means to a lot of people. Kodos felt very strongly about that sort of thing, too.
Tarsus IV was an established colony decades before Kodos arrived along with Simmons and other like-minded individuals. The planet still offered plenty in the way of opportunity for those seeking a challenge. Though many of the settlers and their descendants preferred life in or near the colony's main population center in the city of New Anchorage, others chose to put down roots, figuratively and literally, all across the planet.
I couldn't shake being a security specialist,
says Simmons.
I was barely off the transport ship when the head of the security forces found me. He'd already read my record from my Earth career and wanted me to join his unit. There wasn't a lot of crime on Tarsus IV, but still more than what I dealt with back home. It seemed like it would leave me time for other things, so I said yes. And I was right. The job had its share of minor excitement, but nothing that kept us working overtime.
He sits straighter in his chair, exhibiting an air of pride.
I was able to build my house with my own two hands. It took me almost a year. With the exception of an anti-grav unit or help from a friend to get some of the heavier materials into place, I placed every brick, every shingle, and every piece of lumber or tile myself from the foundation up. None of my tools were self-powered. I cut every piece with a handsaw and hammered every nail, ran all the cabling, and did all of the plumbing. If a friend helped me, then I returned the favor while they worked on their house.
With a smile, he flexes his right hand for emphasis.
Lots of aches, pains, and blisters in those days. But it was damn satisfying watching it all come together and knowing it was through my own hard work. I miss that house. I hope whoever's living in it now is taking good care of it.
Other colonists, including several who had come with Simmons to Tarsus IV, followed pursuits that were even more ambitious. In an age when machines can create meals out of inedible compounds, one might question the need or desire to farm, but agriculture remains a time-honored vocation even on Earth. It is even more prevalent on colony worlds.
Most of the larger farms are within 100 kilometers of the city, but there are a number of others, in all shapes and sizes here and there. Those, along with hydroponics plants and greenhouses, everything from small versions in someone's backyard to big combines, contributed to a pretty diverse selection of locally and regionally sourced produce and other foods.
Simmons pauses again, closing his eyes before releasing a small sigh.
That's why it was so devastating when the infection hit. All that work, and that damned fungus just chewed through it without breaking a sweat. I'm not a farmer, but I know plenty of people who were, and saw a lot of them cry when we had to burn their farms to the ground.
With the source of the contagion believed to be the unforeseen consequence of introducing crops and seeds imported from Epsilon Serona II into the Tarsus IV ecosystem, public tensions rose quickly in response to the escalating crisis. Driven by fear and uncertainty, many colonists, including descendants of the original settlers who had called Tarsus IV home for their entire lives, began searching for something or someone to blame for their plight.
There was a group of us who were never happy with the Federation's decision to relocate the Epsilon Serona colonists to our planet.
Simmons shakes his head.
We all had our own ideas about being left alone to live our lives as we saw fit. Kodos in particular harbored strong feelings on this subject. Sure, you can't get completely away from the Federation, and we couldn't help that a Starfleet outpost was there before a colony started, but we're about self-determination and all that, right? And for the most part, we were allowed to go about our lives, within reason, of course. That's why we went there. And for years, we never had any problems with Federation bureaucracy, and we had great relations with the Starfleet people assigned to the outpost.
He sighs.
Then somebody sitting in some office 100 light-years away makes a decision that upsets everything.
Simmons seems to feel some guilt over his remarks.
Don't get me wrong. Of course you want to help someone when they're in need. And of course we welcomed the Epsilon Serona refugees. There was no other choice. What if the situation was reversed and it was us needing a new home?
He grimaces.
I know it sounds selfish, but I guess we just wanted to have a say before we opened our world to strangers.
With the fungal contamination, however, skeptics and those otherwise opposed to the Federation's decision to relocate those evacuated from Epsilon Serona II found a measure of vindication. It was a short-lived and meaningless victory, as attention turned to battling the contagion and dealing with the aftermath of its effects. Governor Gisela Ribeiro, who many felt was to blame for the whole thing by accepting the refugees, was removed from her post. She was replaced by Kodos, who got right to work asserting his newfound authority.
Those first council meetings after Kodos took over were pretty tense.
Simmons raises a hand, waving away an insect, choosing that moment to strafe his ear.
In addition to the usual group of advisors, they also wanted senior security commanders present to make sure we had the latest information so far as dealing with the public and being able to prepare for possible civil unrest. Some of the council members were still upset by Ribeiro's sudden ousting, but none of that seemed to faze Kodos. He let them vent for a short while, but when he started talking, it was like he'd been in charge forever. He wasn't interested in assigning blame for what happened. We needed to focus on getting through the crisis we were facing. It was a matter of simple survival.
Simmons turns pensive for a moment, as though deciding how best to give voice to unpleasant memories.
Survival was the word Kodos kept going back to. Survival of the fittest and all that. He was fascinated by cultures on Earth or other planets where such beliefs were celebrated. The ancient Spartans, the Klingons, the Andorians. He didn't care much for the more militaristic tenets of those societies, while thinking that other aspects of those civilizations were worth emulating. Even before he left Earth, Kodos had this idea that embracing such a philosophy was the only way to survive if humans were to continue expanding their influence in the universe. We had to take hold of this belief if we were going to survive encounters with other species who might not share our idealistic and somewhat naive views about living and working in harmony and all those other things we're supposed to value.
Further, the people of Tarsus IV harbored goals and dreams of creating a self-sustaining community that was home to the best representatives of various Federation worlds. Long-term plans included the expansion of scientific and technological knowledge, as well as the advancement, if not outright evolution, of individuals and perhaps even entire species. Though things like genetic engineering are against Federation law, this does not preclude scientists and engineers from seeking other means of improvement. Is this a form of eugenics? There are those who might see things that way, and many people with opposing views called Tarsus IV home. Everything for which the community had worked, including its very survival, was at risk. As Kodos and the Council focused their collective attention on the current situation, it was impossible not to dwell on the unpleasant prospect that awaited them all if they did nothing. Distress calls had already been dispatched, and the colony leadership knew that aid was far too distant to be of timely help. The people of Tarsus IV were on their own for the foreseeable future, facing a severe food shortage and far too many mouths to feed. Public reaction to the news was what might be expected during troubling events. In the absence of real information, speculation began filling in knowledge gaps.
People were spinning all sorts of theories and worst-case scenarios, says Simmons. Did we know if the fungus might end up having an effect on us, the way it had already destroyed our food sources? What if it mutated and spread to us? What if Starfleet took too long deciding if we were a contagious biological threat before sending someone to help us? What if they decided to just raise the planet to keep infection from spreading? It was insane.
It was Kodos who put forth the notion that such trying circumstances must call for extreme and perhaps distasteful yet necessary measures.
He called it a revolution,
says Simmons.
At first, he presented it as a way to divide the colony's original settlers from those relocated from Epsilon Serona II. With that done, the two groups would be further segmented and sent to other parts of the planet. It was believed that relocating to areas that had not been exposed to the fungus was a way of defeating the contamination and beginning again. Food processors could be brought online and accelerated farming techniques could be employed to generate new produce. It would be rough going at first, but with determination, cooperation, and a little bit of luck, we'd make it.
Simmons grows somber again.
That was just the story for the masses. After the meeting was over, Kodos held back a handful of us.
He rubs his hands together before reaching up to cover his face for a moment, releasing a long, loud sigh.
There were about a dozen of us, all people who came with him from Earth. Some I knew, but others were just faces I'd seen either on the transport ship or after we arrived on Tarsus IV. Only then did I realize that these were all people who had closer relationships with Kodos than I did, and shared many of his beliefs. When he laid it all out, it was completely without emotion. He reduced the entire thing down to simple arithmetic. This much food, this many people needing to eat, this much time until help arrived. Even with rationing, we were still going to come up too short.
That's when he dropped the bomb on all of us. We could all die, or some of us could be sacrificed to ensure the colony's survival.
More than a minute passes with Simmons sitting in silence, his face conveying the pain that comes from dredging up unpleasant memories.
Kodos said we had to remember that the future of the community had to be the primary objective. At first we thought he meant helping the children, the elderly, and those needing additional care. But he wasn't thinking like that at all. He wasn't thinking along traditional lines about simple survival. Instead, he wanted to remove the weak, the sick, and those who, it was decided, had no relevant contributions to make to the community going forward. It was to be survival of the fittest, and those deemed useful.
A tear runs down Simmons's left cheek. He makes no move to wipe it away, but instead sits still as it is joined by another, both of which run down his face.
To this day, I can't believe I actually believed what he was saying, even for a minute. I was stupid and scared. I didn't want to die. And I didn't want to be one of those chosen to die.
When asked whether he thinks Kodos actually believed the views he was espousing in the hours before the massacre, Simmons nods with conviction.
He absolutely believed he was doing the right thing for the good of the colony. In his eyes, he might be damning himself, but it was the chance to save at least part of the community. He seemed resigned to the idea that history would judge him, if not for the act itself, then in how he went about deciding who'd be sacrificed.
Leaning back on the bench, Simmons releases a grunt of annoyance.
It's almost 10 years later, and I know better, but I can still remember what I was feeling. It was so overwhelming as we all tried to process what we were talking about, but there was also an odd sort of nobility to what he was suggesting. We all knew it was a hard, terrible choice, but it felt right.
He shakes his head.
Damn him, and damn me for believing him. At least, I thought I did. I had doubts. But standing there in front of Kodos, trying to put them into words, I just couldn't do it. I could tell from his eyes that he wasn't convinced I was behind him. And that's why he did what he did.
Questions about the massacre itself are met with resistance, but Simmons eventually offers his version of the events as described in official records and the transcripts of his trial.
I couldn't go through with it. People were gathering in the amphitheater, and Kodos had picked a small group he could trust to help him carry out his order. Yes, I was one of the chosen, but it was crap. Kodos must have known he couldn't count on me, and though I didn't get it at the time, it's obvious he wanted to make sure I couldn't come back to make things difficult for him. He'd taken great pains to conceal his identity from all but a close circle of trusted friends, not wanting to show his face until after he'd carried out what he was calling the sacrifice. Looking back on it, he was simply getting rid of eyewitnesses in case it all went bad, and that meant people like me. I just had the honor of being one of the first people to die before he carried out the larger crime.
Simmons grasps his hands in front of him, squeezing them together in a rhythmic fashion as he recalls more disturbing memories. All these years later, and having lived every day with the consequences of his choices and actions, it's apparent that he's unwilling to forgive himself for his role in the events of that terrible day. A check of the archives for subspace messages dispatched from the planet in the aftermath of the executions reveals that it was Simmons himself who broadcast to the people of New Anchorage that a response to the colony's original distress call had been received. A ship was coming, far sooner than originally anticipated. Simmons had made that broadcast at great personal risk, as it turned out, but in his own eyes, that was not nearly enough to grant him even some small measure of forgiveness.
We were in position at the amphitheater when Kodos sent one of his people to kill me. All the years we'd known each other, and he didn't even have the courage to do it himself. Even with all his big words and supposed bravery in the face of crisis and saving the community at all costs, he was already taking steps to insulate himself from the fallout of what was about to happen. It was just blind luck I saw it coming. I won't bore you with the details, but the short version is that I killed the guy before he could kill me. Then I ran like hell. I didn't try to stop what was about to happen. I was too busy trying to save my own ass. I wasn't a block away from the amphitheater when the execution started. The sounds of phaser fire and the screams carried on the night air and echoed off the buildings. To this day, when I lie awake in my bed in the dark, I can still hear them. I'll hear them until the day I die. And maybe they'll haunt me forever after that.
Simmons shrugs.
Seems just.
23. Standing in silence, Lorca waited before Giorgio's desk while the commander consulted some report or other correspondence on the data slate she held in her hand.
She looks pissed. Well, that was certainly predictable.
Giorgio had not so much as looked up at his entrance after summoning him following her questioning of Alexander Simmons, leaving him to examine the decrepit office the security forces watch commander had seen fit to provide her. The walls, formed from thermoconcrete like everything else in this building, were painted a dull white. Giorgio's desk, along with its chair and the table to her left, were a matched set of gunmetal gray, all scuffed and scratched with age and abuse. On the desk was a standard computer interface as well as Giorgio's equipment belt and a second data slate that was a companion to the one in her hand. After another minute or so of the silent treatment, she placed the data slate on the desk. Leaning back in her chair, she folded her hands in her lap and regarded him with obvious disapproval, but also a hint of concern.
Simmons is back in his cell. Security is doing what it can to corroborate his story. What do you think of what he said?
Surprised by her opening line of questioning, Lorca replied,
"Biometric readings indicate he was telling the truth."
I asked what you think.
I agree with the biometrics.
He was watching as Giorgio had continued to question Simmons, and even without studying the monitors and their information, Lorca knew without doubt Simmons was not lying. He may have thought he wanted to carry out Kodos's order, but at the moment of truth, Simmons wavered. His conscience, though already compromised, had won the day.
"What makes you so sure?"
asked Giorgio.
"He could have killed us at his girlfriend's apartment. It's not like other people working for Kodos had a problem with that sort of thing."
The comment elicited images of Mijen Bao and Pyotr Nolokov. He slid his hand into his pocket, not realizing he was reaching for the small fortune cookie slip until he felt it slide between his fingers. Giorgio's eyes narrowed.
"You're going with your gut?"
Lorca took his hand out of his pocket and crossed his arms.
"And the biometrics. Also, when we found Simmons and his girlfriend, their weapons were set to stun. What happens to him now?"
"He'll stay in holding until Captain Koropati gets a response to the messages he's sent to Starfleet Command and Federation authorities. Until Governor Ribeiro rescinds the martial law order, we've got broad discretion here, and we'll still keep an eye on things. But the captain and I think Simmons should remain in custody of local civilian law enforcement officials."
"I think that's probably a wise choice."
At first, Lorca worried that there might be individuals within the new Anchorage security forces who still harbored loyalty to Kodos. He need not have worried, as Captain Koropati had also anticipated that problem, assigning members of the Narbonne's security detail to the precinct headquarters where Simmons was being kept. Governor Gisela Ribeiro had kept the martial law order in place, along with the curfews and other restrictions that remained in effect. This allowed her to make use of Koropati and his Starfleet contingent to assist wherever she thought necessary. Rising from her chair, Giorgio placed her hands flat on the desk and leaned toward Lorca.
"Simmons is taken care of. You want to tell me what the hell all that was about with you in there?"
Lorca replied,
"No excuse, Commander. I let my emotions get the best of me and I crossed a line."
It was a frank answer, offered without embellishment, and which also had the virtue of being true.
"Well, thanks very much for not making me beat a confession out of you."
"I didn't want to waste more of your time."
Giorgio was too good an officer to have to put up with whatever excuse he might choose to employ. Lorca could not defend his inappropriate actions. Assaulting a prisoner was a direct violation of at least a half dozen Starfleet regulations and civil laws.
The only way to retain Giorgio's support was to respect her and give her straight answers. She made her way around the desk, her gaze hardening as she stared up at him.
You're confusing me, Mr. Lorca. Do you want me or the captain to bring formal charges against you?
I'd rather you not. I'm simply acknowledging my responsibility in this matter, which I accept, along with whatever consequences there might be.
Giorgio held his gaze for several more seconds. As long as we're being honest, I can't say I blame you. Even if he didn't actually help to carry out the executions, Simmons was on board with the idea until he backed out at the last minute. At some point, he was okay with the idea of murdering thousands of people. So let's not pretend he's a precious flower in dire need of our protection.
The command presence returned.
I might disagree with your actions, but having reviewed your record, I'm confident it was an atypical occurrence. Therefore, I don't expect I'll be seeing a repeat of that performance. Am I clear?
Lorca nodded.
You are, Commander.
Given the sharpness in her tone, he was surprised to see Giorgio sigh.
I know you've had to deal with a lot since all of this started. Losing two members of your team. Simmons had nothing to do with that, but he confirmed the raid was ordered by Kodos. He wanted Starfleet out of the way because he knew how you'd react to the executions. If you couldn't stop them, then you'd damn sure try to find those responsible. In that respect, it's probably good for him that we arrived when we did. Were I Kodos, I wouldn't want you hunting me.
I'm still hunting him. For Lorca, this would be over only when Kodos was in custody or in a morgue. At the moment, Lorca had no real preference.
Giorgio eyed him for a few seconds, saying nothing, and he got the sense that she was weighing whatever question she might pose. You knew someone among the colonists who were executed, didn't you?
The question came out of nowhere, catching him completely off guard.
Lorca felt himself all but flinch in response to the direct query, which by itself was enough to confirm Giorgio's suspicions.
Good, he decided. Let's get it all on the table.
Yes, Commander, I did.
Giorgio's features softened. Someone close to you? I know Mijen and Pyotr were your colleagues and friends, but, well, you know what I mean.
Nodding, Lorca felt his jaw clenching.
Yes, I do. She was a colonist. Her name was Belena.
I'm sorry, Commander.
There was no doubting her sentiment was genuine. Lorca saw the anguish in her eyes and was grateful for it. He also knew that duty compelled her to look at this new development with a professional, dispassionate eye.
I can't even imagine what you're going through. I wish there was something I could do.
Anything I could do.
Lorca squared his shoulders.
Don't relieve me of my duties.
Commander, you've suffered a personal tragedy. Not only are you obviously emotionally compromised, but it's simply not fair to ask you to compartmentalize your feelings like that. Not this quickly, at the very least. I have a responsibility to your well-being, too.
And I appreciate that, he countered. But we've got our first tangible lead on Kodos's whereabouts. I honestly understand what you're saying, but I'm asking you to let me stay with this.
He paused, feeling his anxiety level rising. Drawing a deep, calming breath, he clasped his hands before him.
I need to finish it. Not just for Belena, but for all of them.
Standing on the sidelines was unacceptable. He needed to be on the playing field. He could not even imagine discontinuing the pursuit, not now.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, said Giorgio. First, we need to verify this information we're getting from Simmons. If what he's saying is true, then rooting out Kodos isn't going to be easy.
I've already started, Commander.
Even as he watched Simmons responding to Giorgio's questions during the extended interview session, Lorca began the process of piecing together a plan to act on what the prisoner was revealing about the former governor and his followers. According to Simmons, he was a member of the group that helped Kodos locate and establish a refuge of sorts in the mountains east of New Anchorage. The minerals and geomagnetic anomalies permeating the region provided the ideal cover from sensors and transporters, all but allowing anyone to hide from the eyes of modern technology. Kodos and anyone with him could hide for weeks, if not months, among those mountains without any risk of detection. The location would be a closely guarded secret, known only to a precious, trusted few of Kodos's inner circle. Simmons had been in that circle at one point. None of the information he was providing could be trusted on its own, of course, but Lorca already had an idea on how to deal with that. There's one way to guarantee his full cooperation. Let me take him with me. Having reclaimed her chair behind her desk, Georgiou began tapping the desktop with her fingers.
A guide?
Guide or bait. Whatever works. As far as he knows, Kodos thought he was dead. But we can't trust that to last forever. Lorca could not help looking around the cramped, uninviting office. We don't know if Kodos has any loyalists around here. But I'm not betting against it. With that in mind, Lorca had taken steps from the moment Simmons was brought in to keep his presence known only to people with a strict need for that information. He was hoping to preserve the secret of their having arrested someone with crucial knowledge about Kodos, but he knew that would not last. If they were going to make the most of whatever advantage Simmons might provide, they needed to seize the initiative before Kodos or any of his followers could act.
"We can offer him a reduced sentence to secure his cooperation," said Georgiou. "His lawyer will love that."
After the interrogation incident, the commander had seen to it that Simmons was afforded the opportunity to speak with legal counsel. Despite the civilian attorney's warnings to the contrary, the security officer had agreed to cooperate with Georgiou and Lorca.
"Assuming I let you do this, what's your plan?"
"A simple manhunt, Commander. Simmons claims to have knowledge of the base camp Kodos established, so he can lead the way. With all the geomagnetic interference lacing the region, the Narbonne's sensors won't penetrate too far below ground, but they can still be used to monitor activity on the surface. Even if we don't find their camp, our movements may still flush them out."
Lorca sighed.
"Assuming they're actually in there somewhere." It was an unsophisticated strategy, but with the information and resources available to him, at least until more help arrived, Lorca believed it was the plan with the best chance of success.
"If he is there, it could be dangerous," said Georgiou. "You have to think anyone who goes to all that trouble to set up a hiding place is going to take steps to protect it."
Lorca offered a grim smile. "That's why Simmons will be in front."
"We probably shouldn't tell that to his lawyer."
Georgiou eyed him with obvious concern.
"And you're sure you're up for this?"
"Absolutely. Besides, it's certainly better than sitting around here and wallowing in... It's better than just sitting around here. I need to do something, Commander." As though contemplating the potential consequences of her decision, Georgiou dropped her gaze to her desk, and her fingers continued their rhythmic tapping for several more seconds before she drew a deep breath and nodded.
"Outline your plan for Captain Koropati, then draw whatever equipment you need from the Narbonne. I'll release Simmons into your custody. Promise me you won't kill him while you're out there."
Lorca replied, "Only if he tries to kill me first."
"Fair enough," said Georgiou. "You'll have support from the Narbonne while you're in the field. Sensors, transporters, whatever we can scrounge up. We've got a team of SCE engineers with us. Maybe they can build a prison barge out of cargo containers before you get back."
She paused, and her expression changed as though she was processing a sudden concerning thought. A moment later she rose from her chair and fixed Lorca once again with another hard stare.
"I understand and appreciate what you've been through. And based on what you've told me, I can accept your actions against Simmons were motivated by stress and fatigue, and even anger. Given the circumstances, I'm willing to consider them an abnormality. But this is important, Mr. Lorca. I want Kodos punished just like you do, but we are not vigilantes. It's not our job to dispense justice. Bring Kodos back. Alive."
Lorca offered a single, crisp nod.
"He'll face trial, Commander. You have my word.
He had every intention of taking Kodos into custody and dragging him back to New Anchorage, in chains if he managed to find some, and throwing him at Governor Ribeiro's feet. It was the only way justice could truly be served for Pyotr Nolokov, Mijen Bao, and the 4,000 slain colonists, including Belena. Their families and friends deserved to witness firsthand the architect of their death receiving the punishment he deserved. On the other hand, if Kodos decided to fight, Lorca would have no trouble putting him down without a second thought.
24. Sunrise on Tarsus IV. The air was crisp and cool, but not so cold as to require heavy outer garments. It revitalized him, pushing away the last tendrils of fitful sleep. For Kodos, this was his favorite time of day. It had long been his habit to awaken before dawn. That had evolved over the years to include the ritual of sitting on the veranda of his home to greet each new day. Living in the city, he preferred to greet the dawn alone, sipping his tea and watching the darkness fade as vivid oranges and reds pushed outward from the distant horizon before the sun made its first appearance. Without his tea, and having only a flat rock on which to sit in lieu of the chaise lounge on his veranda, he still held his morning routine. As always, he felt the new day pushing away at the fatigue lingering within him. It was a temporary measure, Kodos knew, but nevertheless one that gave him a small degree of satisfaction. These past days, spent living in virtual exile, wore on him. His own thoughts ate at him, forcing him to question the wisdom of his choices and the magnitude of their consequences. Would his consciousness and his conscience ever cease to torment him? He found that possibility unlikely.
And perhaps that is as it should be.
The thought occurred to him as he dropped his gaze to the worn hardcover book sitting in his lap. It was not an original edition, but a facsimile, created to resemble a tome from centuries past. The faux leather was worn and scuffed in places, and the gold lettering on its spine was faded and chipped, but still legible. The complete works of William Shakespeare. While it was true that much of Earth's ancient literature and poetry was lost to time, certain authors and their creations had somehow managed to persevere through the ages. Though he read the usual selections of Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet in primary school or while attending university, it was only within the last few years that Kodos took an active ongoing interest in the celebrated playwright's life and writings. The book in his lap was one of the few physical tomes he had brought with him from Earth. For reasons he still didn't understand, reading its electronic equivalent on a computer screen or data slate, as he had done with almost everything since childhood, did not provide the same sense of satisfaction. There was an energy to the words that was somehow diminished when reduced to pixels on a screen. Here, in a tangible form he could feel beneath his fingers, they exuded the passion, pain, and life captured by their author all those centuries ago. What would Shakespeare think of the situation in which Kodos found himself? It certainly had the makings of a tragedy in the classical mold. Surely the story lent itself to a saga, one of conflict between heroes and villains, to say nothing of long soliloquies filled with reflection and angst. Perhaps a modern playwright would one day pen such an epic tale worthy of the bard himself.
I rather doubt that.
Good morning, Governor. Kodos glanced over to see Ian Galloway standing behind him. How in the world had his assistant maneuvered so close without being heard? Despite being relatively flat, the plateau near the summit of Mount Bonestell still presented challenges to a novice or untrained hiker, which Galloway had proven himself to be during the overland trek here through the mountain passes.
You move with surprising stealth, Ian.
Galloway, slightly out of breath, offered a small smile. Practice, Governor. It's not like I've got a lot of choice, given our current accommodations.
It's the remoteness of our location and the effort required to get here that is our greatest advantage.
Kodos and the others were able to make use of all-terrain vehicles to get them from the city into the unforgiving region, as whatever roads and trails that may have existed beyond the city proper ended well away from here. The small convoy was able to make it a few dozen more kilometers into the wilderness, but even that soon came to an end, necessitating the group to cover the remaining distance on foot. This complication was factored into the overall movement plan with the same